Welcome to Season 2 of Constitutional Defenders, where we discuss important issues and cases related to criminal defense and how criminal defense attorneys handle these cases on a daily basis. Today, we're speaking with our client Lacino Hamilton about his recent exoneration after spending 26 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. Welcome to Episode 1. Welcome to Constitutional Defenders. We are now in Season 2. As always, I am Lizzie Carey, your producer extraordinaire. I am with Mary Chartier and Takura Niamfakudza. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Lizzie.
Hello, Lizzie.
How are you guys doing?
We missed you.
Oh, I've missed you too so much.
We're doing good. We're doing actually great today.
Good. Who do we have with us today?
We are so excited and so honored to have Lacino Hamilton with us today. Lacino is not just a former client of ours because he has been released from prison, but he is also a friend of ours and we know is going to be an amazing colleague in the fight for social justice reform. Lacino was in prison for 26 years for a murder that he did not commit. He was arrested when he was 19 years old and for the next 26 years spent fighting to prove his innocence. We're so excited you're here, Lacino, and we're just really excited to hear from you and to just learn from you.
Well, I'm excited to be here today and had this opportunity to speak with you all.
Thanks. So for those of you who don't know about Lacino's case, he was released on September 30th, 2020, and the only evidence against Lacino when he was convicted 26 years ago was from a man named Oliver Cowan. And this, I can't even call him a gentleman, but this man claimed that Lacino confessed murder to him while they were in the Wayne County jail. This testimony was absolutely 100% false for reasons that we'll talk about in a little bit. Lacino then spent 26 years trying to prove that this testimony was false. And one thing that had never been disclosed was DNA evidence. DNA had been collected in 1994. It was under the victim's fingernails, but it had never been disclosed and it had never been tested. Not only was Cowan's testimony false, but when the DNA was tested, it indicated that Lacino was excluded as the perpetrator. So this is where we are, and we wind up on September 30th, 2020, watching him walk out of prison for the first time in 26 years. And so, Lacino, how does it feel to be out?
It feels great. It feels liberating. It's exciting. You know, the world has changed quite a bit since I was initially incarcerated in the years I spent. So it's a little bit of a challenge. You know, some of the basic technological things that people use every day is somewhat of a challenge to me, but overall, I'm super excited.
You're a quick learner, though. I can say this from personal experience.
So you said there have been some, like, technological changes. I would think maybe, like, cell phones and text messages. Is that what you mean?
Yes. I mean, just simple things. Everything is done over the phone or technology now. It's a little less human interaction than when I was originally incarcerated. So that's exactly what I mean.
You said that the world has changed. In any other ways other than technology that you've noticed?
No, it just seems a lot faster. It seems with the technology, it seems like it's a little less human interaction. So going into a convenience store or pulling into a restaurant or something. A lot of things now are done via technology as opposed to, or some sort of automated way, as opposed to some sort of customer assistance by another human being.
some of that might be related a little bit to COVID, although I think probably the majority of it is just the change in the last 26 years. Takur, you said that Lucino has been a fast learner. Has he been texting a lot and you've been getting into that?
So we have texted back and forth, and I've tested him a few times and he actually didn't know. But one moment I was really excited about today, after we opened his first bank account, got him a debit card, the seatbelt. Today, for the first time, I didn't have to remind him to put his seatbelt on. So he made sure. He did it very slowly, looked me dead in the eye. I'm like, okay, I see what happened there. So, yeah. But, yeah, you know, we've been texting, calling back and forth, and, you know, iTunes, iCloud, and all that sort of thing, we went and upgraded.
Uh-huh, yeah.
T-Mobile account earlier in the week, and you know, we've done a lot of things, and he's been taking a lead, and a lot of them was just a little bit of guidance and pointers from me. So yeah, quick study, absolutely.
Also, he very important, he took his first selfie with me, so
that was a great honor.
Oh yeah, the first text was to you, but I got the first selfie, which I will celebrate until the end of time.
So, Lucino, you talked about that the world has changed. How have you changed in those 26 years?
Well, when I was initially incarcerated, 19 years old, originally from the city of Detroit, a middle school dropout. I know we hear a lot about high school dropouts. I was a middle school dropout. With that, not only not having a formal education, I was grossly uninformed about the world and how the world works. One of the ways of surviving prison was to self-educate. So that is one of the major ways that I'm different now, is that I went from a grossly uninformed young man to a extremely curious, intellectually curious, socially curious, a man today that I am today.
You're a published writer. For listeners, if you just Google Lucino Hamilton, your writing will come up. So for listeners, you absolutely want to check out Lucino's writings now and then what I imagine will continue to come from you. Why was that important for you when you were in prison to write and to try and let the world know what was going on behind bars?
Well, when I originally started writing, it was because, once again, my only means of communication with the world was through pen and paper. It was difficult at first to even construct a simple sentence, right? A simple paragraph. So it became important to read first and foremost to have a way to communicate with the world. But as time went on, the more I read, the more I began to understand how uninformed I was. And it actually became a way of a few ways to express yourself, right? Everything is micromanaged down, time, space, movement, options for clothing or self-expression. So writing became a way that I could express myself. It became a way that I could communicate with the world. And it became the primary way of trying to bring attention to being incarcerated for something that I didn't do.
When you say that writing was really important to you and reading was really important to you, are there authors or books that really spoke to you? I love to read. I think everybody on this podcast, that we're big readers.
Mm-hmm.
And are there, and I know sometimes you read a book and it just, you know, it just almost like becomes a part of your soul and it can be life-changing. Are there any books or authors that really stand out to you?
Well, the book that had the greatest impression upon me, and maybe still to this day, was the Soledad Brothers, The Prison Letters of George Jackson. Mm-hmm. I discovered him by happenstance. He was incarcerated in the late 60s in California, a man who was about the same age as I was. But as I read those letters, I would have thought that he was a professor or, you know, just somebody learned who spent a lot of time reading. But to learn that he was a man with a background similar as mine, someone who had been wrongly convicted, someone with little formal education, that book inspired me to think that someone with a similar background that I could do the same. In the beginning, I patterned myself after not having a writing style or knowing where to begin, I patterned my writing style after George Jackson. It was casual, but it was critical and it was piercing. That book had the greatest impression upon me to this day.
Was that one of the books you took with you when you left the prison?
Yes. So actually, that's the only thing I took for me when I left the prison, with the exception of a few legal documents, was a box full of books. And that was one of them.
You gave everything else away, right?
I gave everything away except my books. I gave everything away except the a few articles that I've read over the years. I wanted to take this information with me, even though I know a lot of this information can be found on computers and smartphones and stuff. It was just important for me to have those books that I had highlighted, those books where I made notes in the margin, some of those books that have been bent and folded and now falling apart. So, yeah, essentially, I wanted to take that back into society with me as a reminder, more so than anything, that it was through education that allowed me to build friendships and relationships and ultimately led to my exoneration.
Well, Lucino, your writing style is fantastic, I will say, because I've read some of your articles, and there was one in particular that was really emotional for me. I believe it's titled, "I'm Buried Alive in a Michigan Prison." And I just felt like that was so powerful and heart-wrenching. So your writing style, for being a middle school dropout, you write fantastically.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a picture. Lizzie, can you link one of the photographs to? Because all Lucino has when he's walking out is mm-hmm. this box, this Apple box filled with books that Takura is, you know, he's pulling on a little wheelie cart, and then you've got a little manila envelope filled with your paperwork, and that's it. That's all that you took from it. And again, I think that just speaks to the power of books and the power mm-hmm. of reading, and
absolutely.
How that was what was so significant for you. So there's no real educational system in prison, right, to educate people to speak of. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate. I mean, there's a few programs sparsely spread out throughout the Department of Corrections, but they're so limited in availability that it's not a stretch to say that there is no education in Michigan Department of Corrections.
Why do you think, I know why I think that education is so important, but why do you think it's so important for prisoners to have that educational opportunity while they're in custody?
Well, I mean, simply, if you know more, you can do more. If you know better, you can do better. When a person is able to add to their information and knowledge base, then it increases not only opportunities that others can, that they can take advantage of, but it creates opportunities that they can create for themselves. You know, when you know how to do something, you can do it. So being in an environment that limits access to educational material, then it's limiting not only access to opportunities, but it also limits what one can do. Don't know much, can't do much.
Absolutely.
Were there prisoners who helped you along the way in terms of, you know, guiding you as to books that you could read or kind of opening your eyes to this really, you know, amazing world of literature?
Yes. So when I first entered the Michigan prison system, I had previously, while waiting trial, been incarcerated in the Wayne County Jail for 2 years. During those 2 years, I had a complete emotional shutdown. I didn't know didn't have the emotional resources to deal with being charged for a crime that I didn't commit. So by the time I made it to prison, I was in very bad shape. And it was actually the men, not the prison itself, but the prisoners who took the time to counsel me, to help try to bring me out of depression, but also to begin to put books in my hand. Prior to prison, I never read a book from cover to cover, never. Prior to prison, I don't think I've ever read a complete chapter out of a book. So coming to prison, I met a prisoner by the name of Adika Menza. He was considered a jailhouse lawyer, self-taught in his own right. He was my first encounter with a prisoner intellectual. you know, I didn't even know that those two words went together. I didn't know that those that type of person even existed. But it was Adika who began to put books in my hand. My vocabulary is so extremely limited. He would write me letters because we weren't always able to spend a lot of time talking face to face. We were in a higher security level prison, but I would read his letters, and reading his letters required me to get a dictionary. Not that these were, you know, so-called big words, college words, but it just goes to speak to how limited my vocabulary was. So Adika, as well as other men, are the people who expressed the importance to me of self-educating, of knowing more than what I know, so I can do more than what I was capable of doing in the past.
We hear so much about prison being a predatory environment, but it sounds like at least in that context, it wasn't true. There were people who really looked out for you. Is that correct?
Well, it is. I mean, prison is it's a reflection of our society. So the same way that we have some very predatory practices in our society, we also have a lot of good people who care about people. And prison is the same way for us. So there's a lot of predatory behavior in prison, but there's a lot of men and women in prison who have transformed themselves, and they seek the same in others. A lot of men in prison spend their time educating other prisoners. Adika was one of those men, and I was the benefit of such men.
Do you think the structure of prison exacerbates the predatory nature of people?
Yes, it does, in the sense that everything in prison is limited, including, I mean, the most basic of necessities, even things like space. And it creates a more competitive environment. So a lot of the behaviors that we see are more based upon the way prison is structured. So yeah, I would say yeah, but I would look more so at the prison itself that creates that predatory behavior.
One thing I didn't even think of is, Takur, do you want to tell the toothbrush story? I had no idea that a toothbrush was something that was like a hot item when you get out.
Yeah, that was so. And so very quickly after we drove from the prison, drove away very quickly, right? Didn't want to spend a second closer to that place than we needed to be. We went, and I enjoy this so much, if I may, indulge me for 1 second. So we went to Capital Prime. I wanted his first meal to be a very delicious, nutritious one. We got him a tomahawk steak, which I think, yes, Lassina, I think you'll agree that steak is longer than your arm, right?
Right.
So when the steak came out, mine was much smaller than his. When the steak came out, Lucino said, "What is that?" I was like, "Wow, that's a dinner." Anyhow, we enjoyed the meal. Then we went on to the hotel. Very big bed, comfy, I believe. By now, hopefully you've spent a few hours in that bed. But Lizzie went and bought a lot of things, toiletries, and one of them was a toothbrush. And as Lucino was opening the toothbrush, it blew my mind when he said this is the biggest toothbrush he'd had in quite some time. And he told me that at one point you ordered 100 toothbrushes because there were prisoners who you knew didn't have enough money to buy them, and they're itsy bitsy. So when you ordered those 100 toothbrushes, the inspector came to you and said, "Hey, what are you doing with these toothbrushes? Are you trying to melt them down and make weapons?" And again, they are much smaller because it makes sense. You can sharpen it, turn it into a shiv, or just use it to cause a lot of damage. And it never occurred to me. Things that we do on a daily basis don't give a second thought to. You know, you brush your teeth, when you wake up, go to sleep, you don't think about the size. So that really, again, that night I went to bed feeling a lot more grateful for things I don't really
for
give
sure.
a second thought to than I did
right.
when I woke up.
I'm glad you liked the toothbrush, Lucino. That makes me happy.
And size matters, right? We know that with toothbrushes, and that's a very important study.
Yes,
the other thing too, when you talked about space, so I shared this with Takur and Lizzie. So when we found out that you were getting out, I went into our closet and my husband was lying on the floor, and I'm like, "What is going on?" And he had looked online to try and figure out the size of the cell, both your cell when you were alone in solitary, and then you know, that you had to share with someone else. And he said, I can't imagine this for 26 years for a crime you didn't commit, that this is your space that you have to live in. I mean, it's so small.
Yeah. So something that people might not think about is the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years of incarceration, I was housed at a prison called Marquette Maximum Security Prison. It's in the upper peninsula of Michigan. The prison was built in the 1800s. I can't remember the exact date, but men and women in the 1800s were generally smaller in size than what men and women are now. So when the prison was built in the 1800s, it was built with those proportions, you know, the size of people then. So I used to always wonder, like, why are these cells so small? It wasn't just a sense of being mean, but it's a sense of that the prison was built at a time when people were generally smaller. So I was living in a prison that was built in the 1800s and wasn't designed for to accommodate the size of people nowadays, you know, that they're generally bigger than what they are now. So something I found interesting, you know.
It is interesting. You are very intellectually curious. I know that from, you know, having communicated with you all these years. I want to go back to something that you said when you talked about that you essentially had a breakdown when you were falsely accused, and then you're standing trial based on a clear lie. No one, you know, can't get anyone to believe you, that you never even spoke to this man. And so the woman who was killed, Willa Bias, who was she to you? Because I think a lot of listeners might not know that.
So Willa Bias was my, or is my, foster mother. And I want to say that became a big issue, like saying it now, my foster mother. You know, prior to this entire experience, I would have never, ever described my mom as my foster mother. I would have just simply said my mom. My mom and my dad and my brother Gary, I became a part of the family at 5 years old. So from 5 years old up until the time that I was incarcerated, it was the only family that I essentially ever known. So that was just a big thing for me, to just wrapping my mind around the foster. And it always sounded like it was delegitimizing my relationship with my family, that I was a foster child, which was the reality, but it wasn't. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, so my mother was a victim. She was shot to death in her home, and to be accused of the murder of somebody that I love, I wasn't equipped to deal with that emotionally. And I had a complete breakdown while I was in the county jail. On three separate occasions while I awaited trial, I was sent to an outside hospital for acute treatment, which really wound up as medicating me. You know, so I was more being medicated into a stupor, you know, really lethargical and not really knowing what was going on. And after 2 years of that, while awaiting trial, I was just in a total, I was in a really bad shape to fend for myself, which once again, I think, was what makes the men who I first encountered at prison. So I went to Jackson. When I first entered prison, Jackson was considered the largest walled prison in the world, the largest walled prison in the world. It was a higher security prison. Most of the men who were housed at that prison probably had about 20 years or more in. So coming to that environment, not able to defend for myself, and have men who the world generally looks at as no good or no value, to have those men really place a protective ring around me and help nurse me back to good emotional health, and then assist me in educating myself, or at least introducing me to the world of enriching your mind. It was some experience.
It's It's really great to hear you say that, just in the fact that there were people there to kind of help you and bring you back. Just because I feel like a lot of people think that if someone's in prison, not only did they obviously do it, but they're a terrible person and they should be there. I feel like that's a common misconception that everyone thinks, when there's really good people that are in prison and deserve to be treated like human beings, because that's what they are.
Good people can make a bad choice or a bad decision.
Exactly.
Right? Good people could be put into a situation where if they could go back and do it over, they would. Mm-hmm. Prison is filled with people like that. Prison is filled with good people who made bad choices or bad decisions. Prison is also filled with men and women that if they could do it again, they would.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I think it's a really a misconception that when people are incarcerated, that society is being done a favor.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're incarcerating these horrible, horrible people, and that's clearly not the case. It's clearly not the case. Well,
so many of our clients, I enjoy talking to them, or you know, spending time with them more
Absolutely.
Than I do a lot of good people on the outside. You know, I'm like, I would much rather communicate with a lot of our folks who, like you said, some people are innocent, like you, and I think a significantly higher percentage than people believe, which we'll talk about in a minute. I think that, you know, people think that your situation is unique, that you were, you know, falsely accused, wrongfully convicted, and wrongfully imprisoned. And in my experience, it's a significantly higher percentage
mm-hmm.
than what the general population believes.
I mean, we had three standing right next to each other once Lucino was released, taking photos together. There were three of them right there.
Right. Absolutely.
Exactly the point that you made is what I was going to say. So, you know, that goes to show, right? We've been working together so long that we can read each other's
right,
minds.
Right.
But to the point that you made about the communication with Lucino, I went back and counted. Lucino, I shared this with you earlier today, but we exchanged over 100 letters. And this isn't, you know, email, JPay, but where I would write letters. I'm sure that there was some stuff that you couldn't even read. But I put it in the envelope, put a stamp on it, and send it back. And I'm just so happy to finally be doing many of the things that we plan. And a lot more to come, right? We're just scratching the surface. Oh, go ahead.
I'm just interrupting you to insult you. You can't blame it on, you know, being nighttime, because your handwriting is terrible. So there's one of the reasons you probably couldn't read it.
It is.
Absolutely.
It's a little.
No arguments out of me.
It is a tedious little handwriting. I'm like, we do not need to conserve post-it notes. Like, you can write bigger on a post-it note. They always hand me a little post-it note. I'm like, I can't even read this. Right? Like, even with my eyes, you know, my LASIK eyes now.
Your new eyes, your good eyes.
I know, my special eyes. Shout out to Pam Amato for my special eyes. Lucino, you and Takura really established a friendship. So you and I communicated significantly more on JPay, which is the email system, occasionally letters, but I'm a big emailer. But Takura wrote you, you know, handwrote you letters. And what did that friendship or, you know, what I consider to be a friendship, and I think that you do too, what did that mean to you, you know, that to have people from the outside communicating with you on a regular basis?
It meant that I mattered, and it meant that somebody cared. A lot of times, the men and women who are incarcerated, in our state and federal jails, come from some trying backgrounds, and those trying backgrounds become more trying when a person is incarcerated. And it sometimes forces families that can't afford the expense of phone calls or the expense of bus rides, because most of the prisons are not located in the communities in which the men and women who are incarcerated come from.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it forces families and friends to have less and less communication with their loved ones that's incarcerated. And over time, it can make you think that people don't care, or people don't, you know, that people that just went on with their life without you. And a lot of time, like I said, it's forced by circumstance. So to have somebody write, to have somebody talk to me about something other than the what goes on in prison, it meant a lot. You know, it meant a lot. It opened up, even like now, as I'm trying to catch up with some of the technological things, but being able to have a relationship that includes what's going on around in the larger society. Because a lot of time when you're in prison, all you know is the prison routine and the prison schedule. And so it meant a whole lot to me. It meant that somebody cared. And that's one of the things that kept me fighting all those years.
We started sending Christmas cards and birthday cards to our clients who are incarcerated because, you know, we want them to know that we care and that we're thinking of them. But I believe we had a client contact us and say that was the first card that they had ever received, like a Christmas card or a birthday card. And just that one card meant so much to them, just to receive a card from their lawyers saying, like, we're thinking about you.
Yeah, I can understand that. Like, because I say it's so much of it's easier to control, and that is the primary concern of the prison. Once you're in prison, the primary concern is controlling the men and women that's in the prison. Mm-hmm. And one of the unfortunate ways of controlling the men and women in prison is to limit their movement, to limit the time that they have to do things, to limit the space. And part of that is unfortunately limit access to the larger society. And with that, it limits the access to family, friends, holidays. So even like now, one of the things that the Michigan Department of Correction has done is limited what sort of materials you can. So postcards have been banned in the Michigan Department of Correction. Physical pictures of, like, you know, the grandkids, mother, father, significant other, those things have been banned in the prison. So,
what's the rationale on photos?
Well, everything collapses back into security. So whenever anything you hear about prison, anything that sounds out of the ordinary, anything that we know just from our common sense, is harmful. The magic word is security. We're doing this for the safety and security of the prisons, and that's the extent of it. There is no explanation why you can't have a photo of your grandmother, or why you can't have a photo of the pet dog, or, you know, there is no. The only explanation is security, and security just basically boils down to controlling you. And when they can cut you off from that support, you know, one of the last things that the Department of Correction wants, or maybe any state agency, is someone looking over their shoulder to make sure that what they're doing is right, or someone looking over their shoulder saying that possibly we could do this better. So all of these things are sort of an effort to limit access to the larger society, limit access to people that can begin to ask some of the questions that need to be asked about our criminal justice system in this country.
I think that's counterproductive, because the more you treat people like human beings, I think probably the more secure environment it would be. To me, you know, like, the more you treat people with respect, the more I think that people would treat you with respect.
Well, I know for sure that corrections officers are taught, like, even as they're going through school to either become a police officer, or corrections officer, whatever, they're taught to, like, not show weakness. And it's almost like they're teaching them to not be kind, or, like, treating another person as a human being. And the reason I know this is because I was in one of those classes, and I was the only person who wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. Everyone else wanted to be a corrections officer. So
I'll say this. I mean, it starts even before. Unfortunately, you know, for the people who even whether it's jail or prison, right? But the prosecutors, the defendant, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Not Mr. or right. Mrs. So-and-so. Mm-hmm. So it starts right as the case begins. You are treated as a number, a file, a thing, yep. not as a human being. Very rarely do they refer to you by your name. So you already have you call something other than your name. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it starts even before you make it to the prison. And in countries like Denmark, I know that they certainly don't have as many people locked up as the United States does, but a lot of their surroundings are in the prison. They have apartments and that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. it's not as big as an adjustment when they are released as people have to make when they leave prison here.
Mm-hmm. We're not any safer. You know, this country is far less safe than countries like Norway and Denmark, mm-hmm. who have vastly different correction systems. And I don't think that you can just say, well, their population is smaller, which is frequently the argument that's made by people who say, well, we can't do what they do. Of course we can. You know, I mean, yeah. we can scale it up, you know, so of course we can. There's absolutely no reason to have such inhumane conditions. Mm-hmm. I will say this, you talked about Marquette, and then I want to get to someone else who you communicated with, Claudia Whitman. But so when Lucina was in Marquette, they moved him. He was much closer to our office, and we were visiting him much more regularly. I know Takur was visiting him, and then they moved him to Marquette. And I do think that might have been by design, mm-hmm. because then you don't have people regularly visiting you, including your lawyers. But they did not know that there is a federal courthouse in Marquette, Michigan. And so even though it's about a 7 to 8 hour drive from where our main office is located, we go up there pretty regularly for court. So I went up there, and then Takura had a couple of free days on his schedule with no court, so he came up as well. So we drove up there, but he did I think he met with you for 5 hours, and there was there was nothing new to talk about with your case, right? So the update on your case would be nothing new, right? Nothing has changed. But he was in there for 5 hours meeting with you.
Yeah, they were changing shifts, so they kicked me out. They kicked me out because they were changing shifts. I was tap dancing underneath that table.
But that had to have been nice for you, Lucino, to still be able to see someone that you know cares about you and to speak with them in person rather than just through letters. So that had to have been really meaningful for you to have, you know, Takura with you and speak with you for so long.
Yeah, it was it was super meaningful. I mean, so I was always looking for something to hold on to, something to believe in, mm-hmm. somebody to believe in me. And that's when I knew that it was more than just, you know, a case, more than just something to be won. Because it was the time invested, you know, those handwritten letters. Those letters that took time to explain, little things going on in the larger society that I didn't know about, taking the time out to drive such a long distance and spend the time. That's when I knew it was more than just about a case. And it sort of reinforced in my mind that it's really about relationships, you know, the stronger connection that we have with someone, then the more invested we can become in them. We can become more invested in people that we know and that we spend time about and that we care about. And I think that made a big difference in the case. It was a big investment made by Takura and Mary. And not just I'm not just speaking on a financial investment, which it was. The case was investigated and pursued pro bono, which means I was broke, and whatever normal money and stuff that charges wasn't. So things like that meant a lot, because it just let me know that somebody cared, you know, and that was something that I could hold on to, and that's something that I could draw strength from.
Well, this case has been really important to us as well, because, I mean, this has been so long. Actually, it's been almost my entire career with you guys, we've been working on Lucino's case. And another thing, just to kind of put into perspective how long you were in prison, you probably don't know, Lucino, but I'm 29. I was 4 when you went in to prison. So you were in prison almost my entire life. So just for listeners, like, I hope that puts it into perspective how long you were in prison for a crime you did not commit.
One thing I want to express, too, is that, so most people comment on the 26 years, which is an experience. That's something they can immediately wrap their mind around, and they don't need any other information about 26 years is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was longer by me knowing I didn't commit the crime I was charged and convicted for meant I never accepted it. Like, I never accepted, like, okay, what's going around me is right. Like, I should be here. Mm-hmm. Like, right now, I should be locked in this cell, or I should be handcuffed, or I should be with a belly chain or shackled, or I should be I just never accepted it, right? And not accepting it made the 26 years much harder than what it might have ordinarily been for someone who said, okay, I'm here, I got a certain amount of time to do, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna leave. I never could accept that, and never accepting that sort of seemed like it created a challenge between the department to make me accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And the department only knows a few things, right? And it's to take or to punish. So I really spent 26 years having things taken from me or being repeatedly punished. And that's like 26 years consecutive, because throughout that 26 years, I never accepted my incarceration as legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, say, I know when people hear the 26 years, but it's what you go through while you're in there, you know, and it's difficult. So I knew it was going to be difficult. But I've always thought that if I accepted it in any type of way as being legitimate, then I wouldn't be fighting as hard as I needed to fight to get out. And I needed to be fighting with everything,
mm-hmm.
because it was all an uphill battle.
I want to talk about that for a minute. So you get convicted based on the word of Oliver Cowan, and on an upcoming episode, we're really going to dig deep into this, what is a vast injustice that has been done in Detroit to numerous, numerous men. Oliver Cowan is a guy who you'd never even spoken to, right? And then he comes in the court and said that you confessed murder to him.
Well, so what was learned through the investigation and through other men who were doing the same thing that Oliver Cowan was doing is that I didn't have to talk to Oliver Cowan, which I didn't, is because the information that Oliver Cowan testified to was being fed to him by the homicide detectives. The homicide detectives who go to a scene of a crime, they investigate, they gather and collect evidence, they talk to whoever they can talk to on the scene of the crime, witnesses, neighbors, and they can begin to put together what happened. They can piece together what happened. The only problem with that is when the police obviously don't have a suspect, or they have somebody who they believe is guilty and they want, they can take everything they know and write out a script to Oliver Cowan and a handful of other men, and they can come into court and they can testify accurately to facts that only somebody involved with the case, whether the perpetrator or the police, would know. And that was the go-to move. After Oliver Cowan testified, the prosecution could turn to the jury and ask them, how could this man, Oliver Cowan, know these details, these facts of the case, if Lucino didn't confess to him? But unbeknownst to the jury, Oliver Cowan could testify to those facts and those because the police also had this information. The detective also had this information. And it's unfortunate or what happened to me. But as you indicated, we believe that there's at least maybe 40 or 50 people, if not more, who are currently incarcerated, just like I was, and who are possibly innocent, just like I was, based upon testimony that was being provided by the police.
It's crazy how long it has taken for that to come to light, with so many cases and so many people likely wrongfully convicted based off of this one man's, you know, false testimony. It boggles the mind.
Thousands of years, collectively, thousands of years behind bars. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some of them are not alive, so they will never be proven innocent.
So when I was one of the questions I've been asked over and over again is about why do I think this happened to me, right? And I continue to say the same thing. I believe that in any competitive venture in life, whether it's cycling, basketball, baseball, playing cards, and anywhere in life where there is competition, cheating is a part of it. There's no way to separate the two. Someone's going to always look for an unfair advantage, and in somebody looking for an unfair advantage, cheating will occur. This is, to me, is one of the big problems with our criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system is based upon competition. You know, in order for police to move up the ladder and in order to get ranked, a lot of times they got to be better than the police around. They got to make more arrests. They got to get more convictions. Sometimes to move up the chain, whether it's a prosecutor or a judge, it's a matter of convictions. It's a matter of, so when a big part of our criminal justice system is competitiveness, then we're saying that, okay, the cheating is going to be in there. But the problem is, unlike cards or unlike basketball or football, where people who are being subject to a competitive criminal justice system are literally losing their lives, right? And so a lot of times, I'm not so much as concerned with, and don't get me wrong, people should be held accountable with the actual police, but to begin the process of how do we create a justice system that's about justice, you know, that's not about the wins and losers, that if this officer only made one arrest, or if this prosecutor only got three convictions, or this judge only sentenced two people, right? How do we create a justice system to where it's not about wins and losers, but it's about the people who have been harmed and about the people who did the harming, and how do we prevent this sort of harm from happening again?
Mm-hmm. Well, and doing it up front, not on the tail end. Yeah.
Right. Right. So it's easy for something. So as horrible as it is, it's easy for something like this to happen because we're all competing against one another, right? It's easy to have this. It's easy to have some type of tragedy or harm happen because the ultimate goal is winning. And so a lot of times when we think about justice, it's attached to a win-lose as opposed to a repair, rebuild. As opposed to that being the goal, how do we repair? How do we rebuild? How do we restore these relationships that have been damaged? You know, how do we repair, rebuild, or restore what has been taken or what has been lost? So as long as our justice system continues to operate on a model of wins and loses, then it's going to continue to be easy for not only wrongful incarcerations, but sometimes even too much incarceration, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, of course, we're talking about innocence, but at the same time, it's a lot of men and women who are in prison who are not innocent, but they deserve a second chance. It's a lot of men and women who are not innocent, but they have began to repair their lives and I think about this, right? So if you'd have let somebody describe me 3 weeks ago, you let somebody from the Department of Corrections describe mm-hmm. me 2 or 3 weeks ago, they probably would have made me sound like the worst person there ever was. But I'm out here walking amongst people who I know don't feel threatened by me. I'm engaging in conversations. Actually, to me, with just as a small sample, myself from in the Ramon Ward, Travis Hernandez, the men who were there to greet me when I, who were formerly incarcerated too, who were released years earlier than what they would have ordinarily been released because they were proven innocent or not. It goes to show that a lot of the people that we say need to be locked up don't need to be locked up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
I mean,
so you have ideas on how to reform the system, right?
I mean, yeah, I have several ideas on how we can at least initially begin. I think that part of the problem with reforming anything is that when we're looking at it, that's the model. See, our model of justice is what is. So in order to truly reform anything but the criminal justice system in particular, we have to be able to imagine a different world. See, as long as we imagine the world the way that we imagine the world now, then we're going to need prison. Because there's certain things in our world that as long as they exist, they're going to continue to contribute to men and women making choices that will lead them to places like they are, or they will lead agencies like the police or like the prosecutor's office to believe they got to get tougher and tougher and tougher, right? So when we say solutions, yeah, but the bigger solution is we have to start imagining a different world. So we can imagine a different world and we can begin to imagine doing things differently. But as long as we imagine the world the way that we imagine the world now, we're not going to truly be able to reform the criminal justice system or anything else, because the things that's in the systems that we currently got were designed for the world the way they are now. So
we are going to have you back to talk about more of your ideas. There's so much to talk about with this case. We have upcoming episodes to really dig in deep on the false witness scandal out of the Detroit Police Department, which actually has occurred in other cities throughout the country. So this is not unique, unfortunately, to Detroit. It has bubbled up in other areas, and it's probably under the surface in other communities that we're not aware of. We're going to have folks from the Innocence Project on to talk about their role on the DNA. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about Monday, September 28th, when we talked to you on the phone and we told you you were going to be released on September 30th. What was that like, hearing that over the telephone?
It was surreal. Like, when I heard it, I knew it was real. There was no doubt in my mind that it was going to happen, but it still had to happen, right? It still had to happen. I mean, I got goosebumps. I had to go sit down for a while. It seemed like I got a little lightheaded, you know. But it was an all around experience. I feel like it affected me mentally. It affected me physically. It was like a miracle. Like I can honestly, like, sit here and say that I believe in miracles, right? I believe that, like somebody said, the dreams come true. You know, I can sit here and say that I honestly believe that dreams come true. That when I heard that I was being completely exonerated and I would be released within a couple of days, I can say that my dreams had come true. That a miracle that happened in my life, because it could have been different. You know, the things at that time, my life was meant to play out different at that time. So it's really an indescribable feeling that I'm still feeling now. Right. I try to tell people, everybody asks, how did you feel that first night? And they laugh when I say it, but I feel like pure electricity was running through my body. I feel like if I would touch anything.
Enter the Dragon, like Bruce Leroy.
That's exactly how I feel. I feel like Bruce Leroy. I felt like if I would touch the lamp, they would have came on, right? So it was an indescribable feeling.
And what was the reaction from your fellow prisoners when you told them, in less than 48 hours, I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be out.
They were excited. So some of the advice that I was getting, and it was good advice, was to keep my head low, keep this information to ourselves. We don't want other men who, we didn't want anything to happen to me because somebody else may be jealous or angry what was happening to me. And that was completely the opposite. So you mentioned Claudia Whitman briefly. Claudia Whitman began investigating my case, I don't know, 11 years ago. Once again, pro bono. She's originally from Mako, where she lives in Mako, Colorado. So she's flying back and forth into Michigan. It's just incredible. But one of the things that through my personal fight for freedom, I encountered a lot of different men in the Michigan Department of Corrections who were also fighting. And because I just had a try anything attitude, don't take no for answers, a lot of men in the Michigan Department of Corrections began to write me letters and ask me for advice on how did I do this, how do I do that, should I do this or shouldn't I do that. So by the time we were confident that release was going to happen, a large percentage of the Michigan prison population were aware of what happened to me, what was going on, and they celebrated. Those men at that penitentiary, they celebrated, they was happy, and they shared in my excitement.
That's awesome.
That's so fantastic. I will never forget, and I'm sure you'll never forget too, the moment that you walked out on September 30th. Mm-hmm. I just the look on your face and the tears in your eyes and the tears in my eyes and in Chris's eyes. I mean, that's just a moment I'll never forget.
Yeah, I'll never forget because I don't remember walking. I think I floated out there. Right? Yeah, the reality of it. Like I say, I mean, you know, but the actual when it happens is just something different, right?
Right, to come out and, I mean, you could walk to the car. And I know the one thing you wanted, we said, you know, tell us what you want. We'll get you, you know, food. Do you want a book, clothes, whatever. You wanted shoes, so you didn't have to wear those uncomfortable prison shoes. So Takur got you those nice sneakers, and we went out to the car, and just like Cinderella, he took off your prison shoes, put on your,
that's right.
And it fit too. It fit. And the last email you sent to me was you reminding me what your shoe size was. Size 9. You said size 9. Right. That made me laugh. So we're going to have you back on. I hope you'll join us again. You know, you're not going to be able to get rid of us. You're one of, you know, our favorite people for sure. Just try, right? We'll track you down. So a question that I have for you, a very serious question. So many years ago, you had indicated that when we talked about what you wanted to do when you got out, not if you got out, because you were serving a minimum 52-year sentence. 52 to 82 years. So when you got out and you said one of the things you wanted to do was go visit private investigator Claudia Whitman, who is an amazing warrior for justice in Colorado. And you said, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I want to do it. And then this morphed into us. We were going to fly you out there when you got out. Then we're going to go out with you, you know, Takur and I, then the whole firm's going to go out. And you know, I like to paraglide in Colorado. And so I said, we'll go out with you and I'll go paragliding. And if you want to come, you can come. And you set us a time, Takur wants to go. You set us a time you would paraglide. So right. The question is, now that you're out and we can't go now because of COVID and because of the weather, but when we get to go next year, now that it's really here. So the big question that's on everybody's mind is, are you going to be a paraglider and jump off the mountain? Or are you going to be on the ground cheering on others who are jumping? That's
with
the
Lizzie.
Question for the day.
With Lizzie on the ground. I'm on the ground.
Lizzie's
so.
On the ground. Takur, what are you? Are you jumping?
Oh, I'm jumping. I'm jumping.
Okay. All right. So
absolutely.
So it's all up to you, Lucina. Where are you?
I'm jumping.
Yes!
You heard it here first, folks.
That's right. Listen, Aspen is not going to know what hits they are. That's right. We're jumping. Okay. Thank you so much for being with us today. We are excited to hear from you. We're excited to hear more from you on upcoming episodes. You have all of our best wishes for an amazing future. And I hope that your voice really resonates around the world and we make some changes in our system. Thank you so much, Lucino.
We love you, Lucino.
All right.
Thank you.